Happy New Year, and welcome to the Science Podcast for January 2nd, 2009. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, a special podcast on education and technology to go with a special section in the magazine. We'll hear about immersive interfaces for learning, computer-assisted education and training in the military, and how a new home e-learning system is leveling the educational playing field in Korea.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
In the computer game River City, students become immersed in the health problems of a 19th century town. Students then hypothesize, experiment, and make recommendations for the digital townsfolk, all without anyone actually getting sick. This is one of the immersive environments Chris Deedy studies, and in an article in this week's Science, Deedy writes about how digital environments, such as River City, can enhance learning in three ways, by allowing multiple perspectives, situated learning, and transfer. I spoke with him about it from his office at Harvard University.
Outside of academic settings, people of all ages are using immersive interfaces for many different types of learning. So it's important for us to understand, for formal learning as well as informal, how to take advantage of the power for engagement and for education that these interfaces have.
What is an immersive interface?
When you're immersed in something, there's a strong subjective feeling that you are having some kind of experience that's really comprehensive and realistic.
So we think of immersive exchange programs where you might go to another country and be immersed in the language.
Exactly. Or it could be as simple as going to a really compelling movie like a Harry Potter movie. And 5 minutes in, you don't think of yourself as sitting in a theater. You think of yourself as somehow being at Hogwarts along with Harry. But the true immersive interfaces involve some degree of visual immersion. So with a head-mounted display on, you feel completely inside of a virtual environment. Your senses are engaged. If you're looking through the monitor window at your avatar navigating through Second Life or World of Warcraft, that's a different kind of immersive experience. But again, your sense of presence moves from sitting in front of the monitor to somehow being inside of your avatar inside the monitor. And then with augmented reality, you're still in the real world. You're less immersed than those two situations, where you walk around with something like a cell phone and you can superimpose the virtual world on the real world. And so you feel immersed in kind of a mixture of virtual and real things.
How does immersion in a digital environment help educate people?
There are several different ways in which immersion seems to be powerful. And one of the things that we know is powerful for learning is being in the middle of a context. So people learn one kind of thing when they're in medical school, but they learn a different dimension of medicine when they're in a teaching hospital and they're in the middle of an emergency room and things are happening all around them. That kind of contextualized learning is a very powerful complement to the more academic and theoretical learning. And in the past, in order to get that kind of situated learning, we've had to use things like internships or field trips or something that took you away from classrooms as places for reflection and interpretation. What immersive interfaces open up is the opportunity to have that kind of situated learning in a virtual setting and then, in a sense, come right back to the classroom physically and be able to take advantage of the physical things in the classroom. So that's one kind of advantage, that we can create really elaborate virtual environments now that enable a kind of situated learning.
Are there other advantages?
Yes, absolutely. One of the reasons that situated learning is important for preparing people for life is transfer. So the purpose of education is not to get high grades or advanced degrees, but ultimately to make you more effective in the real world. And yet one of the things that we know is that sometimes people get very high grades and high test scores, and they don't do very well in the real world. And other times people struggle in academic environments, and then when they get into the real world, they're a huge success. So transfer is not something that easily happens between textbook and lecture and test-oriented environments, and then the kind of performance environments that the real world offers. But these immersive interfaces, because they're situated, offer the opportunity for students to learn performances, to engage in the same kinds of things that they would later do in the real world.
Is there something in particular that the digital technology immersive environment allows you to do that can't be done with a field trip or other type of situation?
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, one of the interesting things about virtual environments is that we can selectively alter some of the principles that govern in the real world. So in the virtual reality work that my colleagues and I did in the 1990s, we were able to create sensory immersion with head-mounted displays and other kinds of computerized clothing in worlds without friction and in worlds in which gravity was set to zero rather than the gravity that we feel on Earth. So that gave students the opportunity to do things that they really could not do in a conventional laboratory kind of setting. We are able to speed up time and slow down time in virtual worlds. Students are able to become very large and watch even a huge phenomenon as if it were tiny, and then they can become very small and watch even a very tiny phenomenon from the inside. So there's lots of kinds of changes in perspective and almost magical suspensions of the laws of nature that we can accomplish in virtual worlds. And the trick to that is to be very principled in doing it and to make sure that students understand that what they're experiencing is not some form of magic, but it's a kind of simulation or model that's going to help them learn complicated material.
So what's needed then before this type of digital immersive interface becomes a standard teaching tool?
I think the primary thing that's needed is much more research on what the strengths and limits of these interfaces are, for what kinds of content they work best, for what kinds of learners they're most appropriate, and where they need to be complemented with more traditional forms of instruction in order to be fully effective. And the entertainment industry is providing the economic and the technical leverage to make this possible. Because education would never be a big enough market that people would develop really sophisticated authoring systems and immersive technologies. Education isn't profitable enough for that, but entertainment is enormously profitable. And then we can retrofit education onto these devices that people are buying for other means. So I'm not so concerned about technical or economic barriers, but I do think that much more research is needed to understand good design, to understand what the limits of these technologies are, and to help us know where they fit into the array of methods that good teachers use.
Well, Chris Deedy, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chris Deedy writes on immersive interfaces for engagement and learning. Read his perspective in this week's Science. One of the most prevalent immersive technologies is the flight simulator pilots use to train on unfamiliar aircraft. These became a commercial success with the advent of the home computer in the late 70s and early 80s, and nowadays, in addition to flight simulators, the U.S. military uses a number of simulation-based and computer-assisted instruction techniques, both for education and for more task-oriented training. In a perspective in this week's Science, Dexter Fletcher writes about how both educational and industrial institutions can leverage what the military has already done. Maybe not in learning how to pilot the latest fighter plane, but in teamwork training, as well as in assessing an educational or training program's effectiveness, cost, and efficiency. I spoke with Fletcher from his office at the Institute for Defense Analysis in Arlington, Virginia.
The military has a long history of investment, both from a research and development side and from an operational side, in the use of technology and education and training. And I do mean education and training because we have a very broad, perhaps one of the largest education and training activities in history concerning the 2.3 million or so members of the armed forces, as well as K-12 education, as well as a variety of war colleges, schools, and postgraduate institutions. So in that sense, the issue is to provide education and provide education in an efficient manner, that may be a little less leisurely done than in, I guess, in classical education circles.
What kinds of education and training is of particular use to military organizations?
It depends on what hat you're wearing. If I am a commander, then I'm particularly interested in collective education. I want to make sure that my unit operates well, and that means that there's an emphasis on teamwork. However, if I am in the training institutions, for instance, the Army's TRADOC or the Navy's NETC, both of these are commands that are concerned with preparing people for specific jobs, then I would be more concerned with individual training and with certifying individuals as capable and prepared to enter into the kind of team training and the team activities that a commander would be looking at for his or her unit.
Now, you mentioned a distinction between education and training. What is that distinction?
I would say that training tends to focus on preparing people to perform specific tasks or jobs, whereas education is more abstract and more general than simply having a focus on a specific task or job. Also, education helps individuals judge how best to use the skills and knowledge they obtain through training. I would also add, though, that training is almost resolutely a means to an end, whereas education is more of a way to organize your life. It makes it interesting for those of us who are interested in research, because in training you can do something in research and see what the results are. In education, you can do something, but you really have to wait for a whole lifetime to determine how valuable your contributions were.
Now, when it comes to military technology, educational technology, we can't help but think of simulators, flight simulators, other types of simulators for battle, combat, things like that. A lot of those have translated over into even the commercial market, and people buy them for their computers. Is the military also involved in educational technology to teach things like analysis and creative problem solving, too?
Yes, and this is what you find in our command and staff colleges, for instance. There are educational programs that are supported to one degree or another by education technology. I think in those cases, you're more likely to find an emphasis on blending the classroom experiences and human-led instruction with instruction that is supported by technology of one sort or another.
What educational technologies have the military used or developed that have overlapped or translated into mainstream education?
To me, speaking just for me, the major contribution of the military has been to initiate new areas of training technology. For instance, in addition to the simulator, the whole simulator world, there's computer-assisted instruction. That whole business started back in the 50s by folks in the military who saw this as an important and an effective initiative that ought to be explored by the research and development corner of the military. Other areas would include the early use of generative instruction. That is to say, we found that back in the, certainly in the 60s, late 60s, we knew that you could use computers to teach very effectively. But one of the problems with them was, in addition to the expense of the computer equipment itself, the problem was the expense in preparing the materials, because in order to prepare them for these very literal-minded computers that we were using and still use, you had to anticipate every possible interaction that might occur between the student and the machine itself. Now, one way to mitigate that expense is to have the machine capable of generating that instruction itself to generate interactions. It's more than just generating problems. It's also to understand enough of the student's understanding of the subject matter to prepare the next interaction that's appropriate to that individual student. Individualization being very important for training and education both, and that's something we've known for some time.
Are there particular examples of computer-aided instruction or generative instruction that have made their way into the classroom? Any names or titles that you know?
I think the kinds of things that the military has done in the area of education and training technology have mostly been to initiate new directions and to pass on techniques and technologies more than they have to pass on specific instructional packages. There have been some, I should emphasize, there have been some, but really I think the main contribution of the United States Department of Defense has been to open up new directions for development.
Well, as you said before, education and training are sort of a means to a very specific end for military organizations, but how might others use the educational technology that the military has developed that maybe hasn't already translated to other venues and make use of the money that's already been spent?
Well, that remains a problem because basically the Department of Defense is a mission-oriented organization and it's aiming at better ways of performing that mission. The payoff for them is, you know, more and improved and enhanced operational effectiveness in the pursuit of military missions. That's different from both K-16 education and industry. That said, there are a variety of areas in which the military has developed new approaches, techniques, interesting capabilities that potentially are of great use in both education and in industry. They involve the training of collectives, that is to say, crews, groups, and teams. They involve the issues of examining the cost effectiveness of training. They've also involved things like looking at the amount of time it takes for people to learn. After all, if the military is paying people while they learn, they would like them to learn very quickly. I think that's certainly of interest to industry. And I would also say it's of interest in K-12 education. And much of what the Department of Defense has done in educational and training technology has been documented, but it's documented in places like the Defense Technical Information Center, DTIC. So it exists, but it's not a place that people in academic circles or even in industrial circles typically turn to unless they have a direct connection with the Department of Defense through a contract or a grant.
And that information is public?
Yes. There are various levels of information within DTIC, the Defense Technical Information Center, but many reports in it are freely available and unclassified and approved for public release. Occasionally, some of the work that is in there is proprietary for companies because some of the work is done by companies. But by and large, a lot of that is open for public release.
Dexter Fletcher, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Dexter Fletcher writes on education and training technology in the military. Read his perspective in this week's Science. A recent government survey in South Korea reported that 77% of primary and secondary students are enrolled in some kind of academic class that supplements regular classroom instruction. To pay for it, the average family there with school-age kids spends about one-fifth of its income, according to one study. In sum, that's about $23 billion, which is $2 billion more than the South Korean government spends on its public education system. In an article on this week's Science, contributing correspondent Dennis Normile reports on how the government is investing in an e-learning system that seeks to reduce the huge cost of private tutors and so help those families who cannot afford it. I spoke with Normile from his home in Japan.
South Korea has put together an e-learning system which has amazing flexibility and seems to be really comprehensive and covers all the bases.
What prompted the development of this e-learning system?
The primary motivator was to offer an alternative to the private tutoring services that many Korean parents are turning to in order to help their kids do their best at school. The private tutoring services The most famous of them are the cram schools, which prepare kids for the college entrance exams. But private tutoring has gone way beyond that, in that kids, even in like fourth grade, are going to private tutors in order to do better on their regular schoolwork so that they will have better grades all through school, because the universities are being pressured by the government to pay more attention to factors outside the entrance exams. Those factors include the normal school grades.
What are the characteristics of this e-learning system that allow it to compete with the private tutoring or the typical cram school preparation?
Well, the instruction can be individualized to a very large extent. The system starts out with three levels of contents. Let me put it this way. For each subject and for each grade, there's three levels of contents, of supplementary, basic, and advanced, for students who are either catching up, you know, pretty much at the level of their class, and kids who are ahead of their class. But within that, the contents can be further customized by each of the cyber teachers. Customized everything from the home page that the kids log into to the problem sets that they're given to work with.
I imagine all of that makes this a less expensive option than private tutoring?
Well, it is offered to the kids for free, so it's definitely less expensive than private tutoring.
Who pays?
The government. How much they're spending on this was difficult to find out, because although it was developed by the central government, it's run by the 16 individual municipal and prefectural departments of education. And I'm sure somebody somewhere has put together a number on what they're all spending on it, but I was unable to find that.
How does it compare in terms of the preparation? Is it leveling the playing field, allowing those kids who are using this free system to compete with those who are getting the private tutoring?
The results may not all be in yet. The system has only been running it's in its fourth year, and they haven't yet done any long-term studies to track how the grades, for example, of those who use this system as opposed to those who use private tutors. The surveys indicate that those who are using the system are overwhelmingly pleased with it. Some have reported better grades. Others have reported increased interest in the subject. But it's still sort of early days to see whether this makes a difference in terms of preparing students to get into the universities of their choice.
How is the system being received then by the education community?
Some of the educational specialists I spoke to, who are based in the United States but familiar with this system, one in particular believes that this system, although Korea has set it up to work with its grade schools and high schools, the man I spoke to believes it's a very good model for continuing an adult education or any kind of education that could take place outside the traditional school. It would still involve a cyber teacher, but the concept could be extended to, you know, lifetime learning, to vocational learning, to any kind of learning that you would want to take place outside the traditional classroom.
As this is funded by the government, is there any likelihood that this e-learning system would replace the school system entirely? Not just for a substitute for cram schools, but the regular government-supported public education?
No. The system is intended to supplement the regular education system. There are some cases in which it is being used as a replacement, for example, kids who cannot go to school for one reason or another. But their intent is to make it a supplement to the regular school system.
As a matter of policy, then?
As a matter of policy, but also the way it's being used in many cases is that teachers are using it to give additional help to the students they have in their regular classes. There are some cases where cyber teachers have assembled classes of students from throughout their district, you know, kids that they don't see every day in the classroom. But many of the teachers are using this to supplement classroom activities. And one teacher I spoke to believes that, you know, technology is not going to do away with teachers. the teacher still has a very important role to play in operating any kind of learning system, whether it's online or face-to-face. And at least this one teacher, Sangmi Kim, believes very strongly that there will be a continuing role for teachers, even using e-learning.
So the teachers teach a regular day at the classroom, then they log on and help their students further. That's making a pretty long day for the teachers, isn't it?
Yes, and that seems to be one of the issues. Korea's teachers are very dedicated, but that is an issue. At the moment, many of them are getting minimal additional compensation for the additional work that goes into setting up and running this e-learning classroom.
Are there any other considerations in, say, translating this e-learning system concept to other countries? I imagine that this would take a lot of internet bandwidth and that kind of infrastructure.
One of the things that educators I spoke to in the United States who are familiar with the system say that one thing which is very impressive, which gives it such power, is that it was a national initiative. The national government took the lead in setting up this. It's really a new kind of educational infrastructure. And once the interest of the national government is, you know, behind such a project, it has a lot more traction, you know, many more resources can be put into it. And people think that that kind of a commitment is one of the lessons that can be taken from Korea's experience. However, they recognize that not every country has the broadband infrastructure in place. And they think that elements of the system can still be put to good use, you know, if someone is working from contents that are loaded on a CD-ROM at a computer center and not necessarily interacting in real time with a cyber teacher. The kids would still be interacting in real time with the software, but it wouldn't be online. That is not the way it works all the time, but it's a possibility. It's another example of the flexibility which is built into this system.
Well, Dennis Normile, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Contributing correspondent Dennis Normile writes about South Korea's e-learning system. Read his article in this week's Science. In addition, you can see a video introduction to the special issue about educational games and tech-based assessment. Find the video and the whole special section at www.sciencemag.org/education_technology. If you missed our regular Science Now segment, it will be back next week with the latest science news. In the meantime, you can catch up on the latest science policy news from our new science policy blog, Science Insider. Find it at blogs.sciencemag.org/Science Insider. For now, that wraps up the January 2nd, 2009 special science podcast on education and technology. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us, and Happy New Year!